Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, let me begin by thanking Dr. Leake for the very kind words he has spoken about me and by all too numerous books. I was rather alarmed, I must say, when he gave the full catalogue of them. I don't think it is a full catalogue, unfortunately. And I asked myself here tonight, well, what exactly am I doing in this company? I am probably the only Bachelor of Arts in this large concourse of doctors in various sciences, and I come here as a kind of ignoramus in the midst of a great sea of specialized knowledge. There is a very curious line which has been preserved from the Greek poet Archilochus, a line which runs as follows. It has been actually made the title of a very interesting essay on Tolstoy by Sir Isaiah Berlin. The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. Now, this is a cryptic line. I mean, in the matter of natural history, it's clear what it means, that the fox has all kinds of tricks, but the hedgehog can fold itself up into a ball and can completely resist the fox. But as Sir Isaiah Berlin points out, it's a line capable of application in many fields. He points out that in the field of literature, for example, there are the fox writers and there are the hedgehog writers. There are the foxes who look over an enormous area, who know many, many things, of whom, of course, the supreme example is Shakespeare. And there are the hedgehogs who confine themselves, who are one-pointed persons, who concentrate upon one idea and develop it to the limit. And here the supreme example is, of course, Dante. But this thing can be applied, I think, in other fields. In the present instance, I think we can apply it to the specialist and the non-specialist. And here I can say that I am a kind of rather low-class fox in the midst of a great number of very high-class hedgehogs. And what am I doing? What is the value of my presence here? Well, obviously, I can't compete with any of the hedgehogs. I listen to the papers here, and many of them, to me, are exceedingly interesting, and I derive a great deal of profit from them. But I confess, when the hedgehogs go too chemical, then I just fold up and don't know what is being talked about. Nevertheless, I do feel that the fox, with his knowledge, rather superficial knowledge of many things, his wide-ranging, many-pointed activity, has a value and can do something, above all, if he's prepared to work with the hedgehogs. We are up against, of course, the great problem of specialization. What is to be done about specialization? I was reading the other day an extremely interesting book which is going to come out this spring, dealing with my grandfather's activity as an educational reformer. He was over and above his activities as a biologist, he was tremendously interested and active in social affairs, and he was largely responsible for the curriculum of the London School Board when education was made universal and gratuitous in England, and he did a great deal in making the University of London into a really modern university with specialist departments in all fields. I mean, he realized that you had to have specialization in order to explore the depth of scientific knowledge. But the interesting thing is that 20 years later, 20 years before his death, he was deeply concerned in undoing the effects of specialization. He wanted to, in some way, to get the people in the University of London, to get the professors out of their separate pigeonholes, and to meet together in a sort of concerted effort to pool their specialized knowledge and to bring it out into the world at large. And it's interesting to note that this, after nearly 70 years, still remains one of our enormous problems. How to make the best of both worlds, the world of specialization, which is absolutely necessary, and the world of general communication and interest in the larger affairs of life, which is also necessary. And here I think the man of letters has a contribution to make. He can, if he chooses to associate a little with hedgehogs, do something to form a bridge between science and the general world. And this, I must say, seems to me a matter of the most crucial importance at the moment. We seem to have a really schizophrenic attitude now. We separate the two to such an extent. And I think it isn't at all difficult to start making bridges. For example, if I had the control of education, I would certainly start pointing out to children of quite small age that the fundamental rules of morality, the golden rule, do as you would be done by, begins on the subhuman level, even the sub-biological level. It begins on the level of the planet. If you want nature to treat you well, you must treat nature well. If you start destroying nature, nature will destroy you. And this basic moral precept is fundamental in our present knowledge of ecology and conservation. And in the same way, what we know now about ecology points to the fact that nature exists in the most delicate balance, and that anything which tends to upset the balance will produce consequences of the most unexpected character and often of the most disastrous character. And here again we are up against, we perceive the deep biological foundations of the ethical sense, for example, so fully developed by the Greeks, the sense that you must never go to excess, the sense that hubris of overweeningness and pride is one of the greatest sins of all. And this is a truth deeply founded in nature. And we see that many of these most important ethical truths flow quite naturally and simply from the scientific facts. And I feel very strongly that this kind of bridging between the two worlds of pure science and the world of ethics should be made from the earliest age. But meanwhile, the man of letters, I think, can do quite a lot to establish this bridge. And meanwhile, I think it's important to point out that in this particular field in which this conference is interested, the relationship between mind and body, brain and body, and in general, physique and spirit, men of letters have devoted a great deal of thought to this subject and have produced some extremely interesting, what may be called pre-scientific, results in this field. For example, if one compares the psychology, say, of the Middle Ages, or say the psychology of the 16th century, with the great literary works of the period. If one compares medieval psychology, for example, with the poetry of Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, one perceives the enormous superiority of the literary artist to the scientific man of the period. And the same is perfectly true of Shakespeare. When one examines the official psychology of the epoch, one is amazed by its crudity. But when one looks at the plays of Shakespeare, one is still more amazed by the enormous subtlety of the psychology and the penetration which was shown by this extraordinary man. And it is an interesting fact that official psychology, scientific psychology, does not begin to catch up with literary psychology until well on in the second half of the 19th century. Before what may be called modern psychology, It's incredible to see the barrenness of the official psychological doctrines in comparison with the literary psychology of such novelists as Balzac or Dickens or George Eliot or Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. One is astounded at the poverty of the scientific formulations in comparison with the extraordinary richness and subtlety which these men, by observation and intuition, had set down in their novels. And it's amusing, too, to see the way in which certain of the problems which are being discussed now, the effect of drugs upon the mind, were discussed and understood by the great masters of literature in the past. I mean, we were mentioning the problem of alcohol just now. It's interesting to see how the great masters of literature in the past perceived the fact that the effects of alcohol were profoundly different according to the temperament and constitution of the persons who took it. And incidentally, I haven't attended all the sittings of the conference to date, but among those I have attended, I was struck by the absence of reference to the profoundly important fact that the human species is more variable than any other species in the whole realm of nature. In general, we may say that species variability increases as we rise up the evolutionary scale, and that the maximum of variability is in the human species, that we are profoundly different as individuals, one from another, both structurally and even biochemically. And it's interesting, for example, to see the way that Shakespeare, for example, points out that the drunkenness, for example, of a Falstaff is totally different from the drunkenness of a Cassio, who is this big military figure belonging to the extreme of what Sheldon would call the somatotonic pole of human variability, and that both these drunkennesses are again quite different from the drunkenness which would be manifested, for example, by a person of my kind of physique, which I would be probably feel extremely ill and be very, very melancholy. Cassio would be extremely aggressive, and Falstaff would be extremely jolly. And of course, this profound variability between individuals is to be noted, I suppose, in regard to not merely to alcohol, but to all other drugs. And I merely point out this fact to show that the literary man has made very acute observations from very early on in the history of culture. So that we are, as I say, we are not completely useless. There are many things we can do, and I think that at the present moment I do feel very strongly that it is one of the functions of literary men to act as bridges between the specialists on the one hand and the non-specialists who constitute the great mass of the world on the other. And then we come now to the question of language. In his paper yesterday, Dr. Elkis stressed the fact that the language is lacking very much for discussing many of these problems, and he expressed the hope that within a short time we should be able to make use of mathematics for discussing these questions. Well, so far as the general public is concerned, mathematics is not very helpful. And here again, the man of letters, I think, can do a very important task. And this is an incredibly difficult task. I mean, our problem is to adapt a language which is really not in the least suitable to describing a continuum of mind and body, a universe of complete continuity. This, our language, as I say, is not at all well adapted to this, and we have to somehow or other to invent some means of talking about these problems in an artistically valid way, which shall present them and make them accessible to the general public. Ideally, for example, we ought to be able to talk about, say, a mystical experience in terms simultaneously of theology, of psychology, and of biochemistry. I mean, this is, of course, a pretty tall order. But unless we can do something of the kind, it will remain extraordinarily difficult for people to think about the continuous web of life, to think about it as a continuum, and not in terms of the old Platonic and Cartesian dualism, which so extraordinarily falsifies our picture of the world. How we are going to do this, how the literary men are going to achieve this miracle of language, I don't know. But I think it has to be achieved, and maybe we shall, some future Shakespeare will arise with an immense command of language, who will be able to take our existing English and somehow, by some miracle of poetry or miracle of poetical prose, render this picture of a continuum. This is something I myself have thought about a great deal, and frankly I just do not have enough talent to do this, but I feel very strongly that it needs to be done, and I hope that someday or other it will be done. As long ago as the beginning of the 19th century, Wordsworth, in his preface to the Lyrical Ballads, made the statement that the time would come when the remotest discovery of the physicist and the chemist would become a suitable subject matter for poetry. Well, more than 150 years have passed since then, and still these two fields remain very much apart. We haven't, it must be stated, that we have not yet made the necessary fusion. And this is a matter I feel that men of letters should think about very carefully. It's, as I say, the problem is an incredibly difficult one, but it presents a challenge which certainly we should try to meet, because the need for such a new language expressive of the fundamental unity of the world is enormously necessary, I feel, at the present time. Well, so much for a sort of apology for my existence here. Now, let us get down to this, what is supposed to be the theme of this talk, which I've called the ultimate revolution. This is, to my mind, a very interesting and very important problem, to which the present conference is, in one way, quite relevant. The ultimate revolution, as I see it, is the application to human affairs, both on the social level and on the individual level, of technology. Now, what is technology? Technology, a technique in general, I suppose, is the application in a perfectly conscious and rational way of well thought out methods of doing things efficiently. The watchword is essentially efficiency. And the beginnings of technology in modern times, of course, were to be seen in the field of industrial production, in the field of applying machines and factory work to the problems of producing, first of all, woven goods, then metallurgical goods, and increasingly in other branches. But of course, hand in hand with the application of technique to the methods of production, with the creation of more and more complicated machines, it became necessary to apply technique to specifically human spheres. In general, we may say that the more complicated the physical machinery is, the more complicated does the organization have to become in the society which has to use these machines. The application of technique to sociological and political and governmental problems, of course, is very ancient in a rather sporadic way. For example, we read in the Old Testament, it occurs both in the Book of Samuel and the Book of Chronicles, we read that King David ordered the numbering of the people. He ordered a census, which is, of course, one of the first procedures which any efficient and technically minded government has to do. But it's interesting to note that he ordered it expressly against the will of Jehovah and expressly as the result of temptation by Satan. So that we see that in this Bronze Age period in which the book of Samuel and of Chronicles was written, there was a strong anti-technical feeling. People felt very strongly that there was a great danger in letting the government come in and find out all about them, which is what a census is. And there is, of course, a great deal of foundation for such a suspicion, because in point of historical fact, we see that one of the great bulwarks of liberty has always been inefficiency. The desire to be a tyrant has existed very frequently, but the means for being tyrannical have been extraordinarily inadequate. The spirit of despotism was strong, but the flesh was weak. Take a case, for example, like Louis XIV. I mean, Louis XIV proclaimed himself an absolute monarch and would have liked to regiment everybody. But in point of fact, his technical armory was extremely inadequate, and it was quite easy for individuals to slip between the meshes of his very widely woven net and escape altogether. And even in the time of Napoleon, one is struck by the inefficiency of his police chief, Fouché, who was a man of enormous ability and who had a highly organized department, but compared with the efficiency of police forces even in the democratic state today, these people were wildly inept, and there was a great deal of individual liberty simply because the people on top couldn't get hold of the masses. They were unable to regiment them, however much they wanted to do so. Well, these sporadic and preliminary efforts at what may be called technicizing governmental control, of course, have gone on all through history, where certain societies have made surprising advances. And for example, the Roman world was amazingly well organized in many ways. They technicized the military forces in a way which they were never technicized again until certainly the second half of the 18th century. They had a technical and rational system of law, such as again as we didn't see until the time of Napoleon and the reform of the English law during the 19th century. But of course all this disappeared, and we had during the Middle Ages an extraordinarily anti-technical, non-technical world in which organization was, so to speak, it doesn't like to use the word, but it was in a way natural. They were the organizations which grew up, the guilds, for example, which grew up from the association of people doing the same sort of thing. without any kind of worked out system, it was all remarkably inefficient and required, of course, to be completely broken down at the time of the French Revolution in order to make possible the great developments of technology which followed thereafter. What may be called these natural societies had to be atomized and broken down so as to permit organization on the grand technical scale to take place. Well, today we see the application of technique to human affairs on a greater and greater scale in all countries. And for myself, I would say that the really important distinction between the communist world and the world of the West is based not really on a Marxist theory, in as far as that calls for the public ownership of the means of production. I don't think this is the really important factor in the situation today. It is the sort of mythology of the Soviet world. But the real fact is, surely, that the communists are prepared to permit technicization to go to the absolute limit, whereas we have considerable qualms about allowing this thing to override our old traditions of personal liberty and democratic institutions. Even in Marx and in Engels, one sees the extraordinary importance which these writers gave to the technical aspect of social organization. And what we certainly see in Russia now is a world in which technology is given completely free play, and in which man is more and more subordinated to the needs of technology. I mean, the nature of the tyranny, it seems to me, is essentially the tyranny of a man who is, in his deeper nature, a spontaneous, rather lazy, spasmodic creature. His subordination to technical devices which make him work regularly, steadily, and in accord with a prearranged plan. He is the slave of a totalitarian society, which is the expression of an immensely highly technicized organization. And one of the dangers, it seems to me, that confronts us is precisely this, that we are being forced by technology along this same road which the Russians have voluntarily taken, that we are being pushed this way. Technology tends to grow and develop according to the laws of its own being. It doesn't at all develop according to the laws of our being, that the two things are quite separate, and that the man now finds himself subordinated to this thing which he created, and subject to its laws, which are not at all human laws. And this seems to me one of the gravest dangers which confronts us now. And we see this technicization going on in many, many fields. For example, in the field of government, it is becoming, even in the liberal and democratic governments, it's quite clear that the whole apparatus of government is becoming more and more technicized. For example, in this country, there are, I believe, no less than 56 agencies of the government dealing with statistics alone. I mean, it is so necessary for us now to have this immense armory of technical knowledge in order to permit the thing to run at all. And then the actual powers of the government have been so immensely strengthened by the advances in technology. The police, for example, have powers which, as I said just now, the police of Napoleon simply couldn't approach at all. And it's not merely a question that they possess superior arms or that they possess the means of communication which the older police forces did not possess. It's also a question that they have extremely elaborate methods of recording things. I mean, there is that everybody's position is recorded on punched cards and on microfilms and so on. This is an entirely new fact. There is an immense mass of information about everybody in the hands of the central government, which never existed before. But this thing for which David was punished has now reached a pitch of perfection which was absolutely unimaginable even 100 years ago. So that when this is only one of the fields in which we see the advance of technique, we see it again, of course, in the economic field, where even in the Western countries, the old habit of leaving the economy entirely to the free market is largely replaced by a most elaborate system of plans going on everywhere. And there is this planification according to a carefully worked out rational method, which is a feature not merely of the totalitarian states, but of all the democratic states as well, a little less wholeheartedly in the democratic states, but nevertheless it is an important feature even there. And in general, I would say that this speeding up of technicization is being even further accelerated by the enormously rapid increase in numbers at the present moment. As numbers increase, so do the problems of organization, the difficulties merely of doing something about these numbers, and the enormous difficulties which arise as numbers press more and more heavily upon resources, entails inevitably a much more intensive planning activity of the central government, and the entails further and further technicization of all activities, so that it seems almost inevitable that as numbers increase during the next 50 years, as they evidently will, we are increasing now at about over 45 million a year in the planet, that as this happens, I think we must inevitably see a further technicization and a further strengthening of the central government, a further usurpation of functions which used to be in the hands of private people by the central authority. And now we come to the most interesting and possibly the most alarming aspect of this technicization of human life, which is a technique as applied to individuals, not merely to societies on a large scale, but to the individual. And this can be divided into various categories. There is, first of all, of course, the amazingly well-developed technique now of propaganda. Propaganda may be defined as opposed to rational argument, argument based upon facts. Argument based upon facts aims at producing an intellectual conviction. Propaganda aims above all at producing reflex action. It is aimed at bypassing the rational choice based upon the knowledge of facts and getting directly at the solar plexus, so to speak, and affecting the subconscious. And of course the efficacy of propaganda was demonstrated on the most terrifying scale in Hitlerian Germany, It is demonstrated again in the communist dictatorships, and it is demonstrated in this country by the extreme effectiveness of commercial advertising. And this technicization of the means of getting at the human unconscious is, to my mind, presents an enormous danger to our whole traditional conception of democracy and of liberty. It seems to make complete nonsense of the democratic process, which is after all based upon the assumption that voters make a rational choice on the basis of the facts supplied. I mean, when one reads in a book like The Hidden Persuaders that in this country both political parties employ advertising agents to run the machinery of their campaigns, one is extremely alarmed, and one wonders how long the democratic tradition can go on surviving in the teeth of a technical method which is carefully calculated to bypass rational choice and to affect people on a level below reason, on almost a physiological level. This is a very, very grave question. Then we see again the technicization of persuasion as it is manifested in the processes of brainwashing, which are based very carefully upon the work of Pavlov, and which, as far as we can judge from the results achieved in China and achieved among war prisoners in Korea, are exceedingly efficient and are probably going to become more and more efficient as time goes on. And finally, we come to the question of attacking the human being on the physiological level by pharmacological means. And here is where the present conference, I think, has to start thinking about what is going to happen to these drugs as they are developed. How are they going to be used? How are we going to be sure that they will be used well? It seems to me perfectly on the cards that suppose, for example, that a euphoric drug far more efficient and less harmful than alcohol is produced, which seems to be perfectly on the cards, and if this should be made available, if it should be introduced into every bottle of Coca-Cola, then clearly, as I ventured to point out more than 20 years ago in Brave New World, this could become an incredibly powerful instrument in the hand of a dictator. What is becoming, I think, quite clear now is that the dictatorships of the future will probably not be based on terror as the dictatorships of the immediate past have been, the dictatorships of Hitler and the dictatorships of Stalin. Terror is an extremely wasteful and stupid and inefficient method of controlling people. The Romans discovered this many years ago. They, as far as possible, they tried to rule their empire by consent and not by mere coercion. And we are now in a position to do far better than the Romans because we have this enormous armory of techniques which will permit the rulers to make their subjects actually like their slavery. In Brave New World, I made the distribution of this mysterious drug, whose name has now been taken by the Wallace Laboratory, for something which is not nearly as good, I may say. The distribution of this drug was a plank in the political program. It was one of the great, it was simultaneously one of the great instruments of power in the hands of the central authority, and at the same time it was one of the great privileges of the masses to be allowed to take this drug because it made them so happy. And this, it naturally was a fantasy, But it's a fantasy now, a great deal nearer to being realized than I thought it certainly was at that time. And it seems to me perfectly on the cards that there will be within the next generation or so a pharmacological method of making people love their servitude and of producing a kind of producing dictatorship without tears, so to speak, producing a kind of painless concentration camp for entire societies, so that people will in fact have their liberties taken away from them, but will actually rather enjoy it, because they will be distracted from their any desire to rebel by the fact of propaganda, brainwashing, and brainwashing enhanced possibly by pharmacological methods. And this seems to me to be precisely the final revolution. In the past we've had revolutions which were all on the periphery of things. The environment was changed in the hope of changing the individual at the center of the environment. Today, thanks to the application of techniques to human beings, we are in a position to change the human being here at the very center, so that he will not have to, the present revolution, this ultimate revolution, will concern the man and the woman as they are, and not the environment in which they live. And in this consists, I think, the extraordinarily powerful and the ultimate nature, I don't see how one can go any further than this, the ultimate nature of this revolution. Now the question arises, what, if anything, can be done about this steady advance of technicization? It's obviously quite out of the question of stopping technicization. This is going on whether we like it or not. And also it seems perfectly clear that without a steady increase of technicization in many fields, it would be almost impossible to manage or to provide a decent life for the in rapidly increasing numbers of the human species. So that we have to put up with the fact that this technical process is going to go on, and is going to go on developing according to the laws of its own being, exactly as it's developed before. That it's going to be developed for the purpose of producing more and more efficiency, not necessarily at all for the purpose of producing fully developed human beings. It has nothing to do with it, nor have any questions of ethics got anything to do with it. Categorical imperative of the technology is efficiency. What it is out for, what it is working for, and for nothing else. Now the question is, can we resist this? Can we make the best of both worlds? It's not a question, as I say, of hoping to abolish techniques. This is quite hopeless, I think. It's a question of somehow making the best of both worlds so that we can enjoy the results of technology, which is order and efficiency and a profusion of goods, and at the same time enjoy what human beings have always felt to be of supreme importance, that is to say, liberty and the possibility of spontaneity. This question of spontaneity is terribly important, and it is actually one of the great enemies of technique. A human being living in a highly technicized productive unit is simply not allowed to be spontaneous, because it just interferes with the plan laid down in advance by the engineers and technicians who decide how he shall work. And in this way, the human being is profoundly diminished, because he is not permitted to be spontaneous. Well, our problem is to find some way of permitting this spontaneity to come to the surface, of allowing liberty to exist, and yet to allow technique to develop to the limits to which it has to develop without any doubt. And this is an incredibly difficult problem, and it's a problem which is exceedingly urgent, because this is something which I certainly have learned in the last few years, because in a light-hearted way, when I wrote Brave New World in 1932, I imagined that this sort of world